This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
I don't know quite when everyone grew up in this room, what decade. I know there's a current like social media thing that like millennials are supposed to hate boomers, and I'm like Gen X, so it's so crazy. But during my high school and college years, which for interest of full disclosure was the 90s, there was a phenomenon that everyone had to reckon with in one way or another, and it was the magic eye puzzle. Do you remember this? The magic eye puzzle. The idea was that you stared deep into this picture that was like 3D, and it looked like a glob of fuzzy TV static back when we actually had TV static, right? We don't have that anymore, it just goes black. But back in the day, it used to be like all grainy, and if you stared at that, if you stared at this image long enough, you could see an image that would emerge out of the mess. You could get magic eye books based on your favorite characters. And yes, if you were wondering, they did make a Seinfeld about this. So in true 90s fashion, here's how it went. So it's when Kramer, who's the kind of crazy guy of the show, showed up at Elaine's work, and Elaine worked for a guy named Mr. Pitt. And so Kramer walks in with a 3D magic art eye puzzle, whatever. And so Mr. Pitt says, oh, this is very odd. And Kramer looks at the picture and says, yeah, it's 3D art. Computers generate them, big computers. And Mr. Pitt says, yes, I've heard about those. How do they work? And Kramer says, well, you blur your eyes like you're staring straight through the picture, and you keep your eyes unfocused, and then, oh, yeah. And Mr. Pitt says, I still don't see it. Kramer, yeah, it's a spaceship surrounded by planets and asteroids. Mr. Pitt says, I still don't see it. And so then Elaine says, okay, Kramer, that's enough. Mr. Pitt has work to do. And Kramer says, do you ever dream in 3D? It's like the boogeyman is coming right at you. A spaceship where, and Kramer says, right there, just keep your eyes unfocused. And then he can see the image. And Mr. Pitt, that's the whole episode. He can never see the image. Misses deadlines at work, makes mistakes. That's the whole plot line. So you get the point, right? Magic eye puzzles. Sometimes it's hard to see. It's difficult to see what's happening in plain sight. That's the idea of a magic art puzzle, magic eye 3D puzzle. And it's very much how we should be thinking about God's kingdom. That's what Jesus said in Matthew 13, verses 31 through 33. Here's what Jesus said. He put a parable before them saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of a mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It's the smallest of all seeds. And when it is grown, it's larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman took and hid in three measures of flour till it was all leavened. So the point Jesus is making is God's kingdom doesn't work, or it doesn't look like we would expect it to. There's all kinds of expectations that are burst when we come to God's kingdom, but it is decisive. We're told to pray, just in the model prayer says, pray that God's kingdom would come and his will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. And the early church was marked by this. If you look in the book of Acts, they're always like preaching about the kingdom coming, and being in or out of the kingdom matters. And for those of us who believe in Jesus, we become heirs of the kingdom, and Scripture tells us we've received a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And because we've been made a kingdom, we're to give praise to God. And all of this is relevant for us as we're walking through the story of David and his kingdom. There's something that it's pointing to. It's pointing to something big, to a kingdom that's coming. David's is showing us that God's kingdom is going to come. And there's some connections we can make there. Now last week in 2 Samuel 7, that was one of the most significant chapters really in the Old Testament, but certainly in 1 and 2 Samuel. God made some pretty amazing promises to David about what he would accomplish for him, that is, what God would accomplish for him. And in these two chapters that we have today that we're going to try to look at, 2 Samuel 8 and 9, we're going to see some of the implications that go with the kingdom. I'm calling this sermon Kingdom Promises because 2 Samuel 8 and 9 are showing us something about God's kingdom. They're showing us about how God on the one hand, keeps his promises, and on the other hand, how we can keep promises, encouragements for us as kingdom promises are fleshed out in David's life. So I hope these encourage you. And most of the thrust of this passage still relates to God. So, again, it's not like the awesome, like necessarily life-changing moments, but it's teaching us something about God that as we walk with him, we can have firm footing in this world, telling us about who he is, what he said he would do, and whether or not we're going to go through life trusting in him or not. That's the issue, right? Are we going to believe God's promises or not? Are we going to put our trust in him? Are we going to go full in on him? Are we going to drop anchor in what God has said, or are we going to try to, you know, construct all this on our own? And so your trust in God changes everything, and I hope these passages encourage you to trust him all the more. And I think the trust that we have in God enables us to live. It enables us to live related to others. So this is all where these two chapters are headed. And we have a lot of funky names to read, and we have a lot of funky things to see. So it's going to be really interesting. This is where we're headed today. So I invite you to join me as we see two encouragements related to God's kingdom. Two encouragements related to God's kingdom. And let's begin by reading 2 Samuel 8. So follow along with me there as we read. And again, just know, I'm just putting it out there, you're going to look across a name that I'm reading and say, well, that's not how I would have said it. And just get ready, because there's a ton. And you can hash it out over dinner, you know, like, I thought that should have been Magamanabub, or whatever, yeah. So here we go, verse 1. After this, that is, after all the events of chapter 7, these amazing promises, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Methegama out of the hand of the Philistines. And he defeated Moab, and he measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. Two lines he measured to be put to death, and one full line to be spared. And the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 men of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Aram of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem, and from Batah and from Barathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took very much bronze. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer, Toi sent his son Joram to King David to ask about his health and to bless him, because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had often been at war with Toi. And Joram brought with him articles of silver and of gold and of bronze. These also King David dedicated to the Lord, together with the silver and gold that he dedicated from all the nations he subdued, from Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, Amalek, and from the spoils of Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. And David made a name for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Then he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Joab the son of Zeruiah was over the army, and Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilad was recorder, and Zadok the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech the son of Abiathar were priests, and Sariah was secretary, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were priests. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So two encouragements related to God's kingdom. That's right. Just 2 points today. One for chapter 8, one for chapter 9. We can all go home and be ready. But two encouragements. And the first encouragement we see comes in chapter 8. We can be assured that God will keep his promises. Now last week we could be assured that God will make promises, and part of the application there was God's going to make promises, and he's big enough to make promises that he can keep. That's who God is. And this is kind of the flip of that, right? God will keep his promises so we can trust him. So in chapter 8, we have God, in a sense, fulfilling the promises he had made to David in chapter 7. The promises of a dominion, a dynasty, rest, and a house are all fulfilled here, though not in the ultimate forever sense, right? We know that ultimately the fulfillment's going to be in Jesus. And we know this is the case, that God's working fulfillment here, because chapter 8 begins with after this. So again, I kind of said that when I read it, but it ties the happenings of chapter 8 to what had been said in chapter 7. And another note here is that I don't think we should read chapter 8 like chronologically. It's not like we read this and say, oh, so he kind of went there and then here and there. No, I think this is just kind of giving us some broad thematic sweeps, right? Where we're seeing how God fulfilled all of his promises to David, and he did it. The focus is not on the timetable of this. It's just that God did it over the course of David's rule. So it's not as much as a precise timeline as to we see the extent to which God kept his word. And we do see in this chapter some pretty incredible stuff. Look at all the times it was repeated, like David subdued, or he defeated, or he struck down his enemies. If you noted all those, that's all the same word in Hebrew. So David struck down, or he defeated, or he subdued his enemies. That's the same concept in Hebrew. And the summary statement we came across twice, right in verse 6 and in verse 14, that the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. That's the point. Out of the gate in verse 1, David defeats the Philistines and captured Metheg Ammah. In verse 2, Moab is the enemy and David executes God's justice on those who oppose him. In verse 3, Zobah's king, Hadadezer, is defeated. And we're told David took horsemen and foot soldiers, hamstrung chariot horses, and ended up defeating Syrians from Damascus when they came to help. God's victory, that is all on the north side, was very telling. Verses 1, 2, 3, all the way down into verses 4 and 5. Those are all kingdoms kind of to the north of Jerusalem. And God's kind of keeping his word, north and to the east. God's fulfilling his word there, even to the west with the Philistines. In verses 13 and 14, down to the bottom, with the Edomites, David gained renown as he struck down the Edomites. This was a victory the Lord gave to the south. So David, with God's help, is achieving rest from his enemies. And as the land allotment is increasing, right, of all these people bringing tribute to David, the kingdom's expanding. And as the kingdom expands, God's not only saying, see, I'm fulfilling everything I told you I would do. I'm fulfilling all these promises to you. We know, because we've read other parts of the Bible, right, that God made these incredible land promises to another guy named Abraham. We know that God's fulfilling these promises. This is what this is reminding us of. This is the shoe dropping. Oh, God keeps his word. He's going to do that. And then we have this curious thing in the middle in verses 7 through 12. David's taking his shields of gold and bronze in the defeat of Zobah. He's receiving gifts of blessing because Hadadezer's enemy Toi now had rest. Articles of silver and gold and bronze are brought. And in verse 11, we're told that all these articles, all this wealth, wasn't just like melted down and made to be rings for all of David's wives. We're told, no, this was all dedicated to the Lord. And it was dedicated to the Lord from all the nations. This spoil and these gifts were for the Lord. They weren't for David. God is the one who had abundantly blessed. God is the one who had given this victory. And so we get a summary of that blessing at the end of chapter 8, right? Verses 15 through 18. That David's reign wasn't like Saul's. Saul's reign was like watching a car accident, and you just like couldn't look away. Like, what's he going to do now? Is he lost his mind today? How's he doing? You know, it's just kind of we're watching that, and he's just foolish. And we have this summary here that David's rule was characterized by justice and equity to all his people. I mean, this is an amazing thing, right? In verse 15, David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. I mean, this is the kind of ruler that the people wanted, and God was blessing. David wasn't working so that everybody cowered in fear before him. No, David was serving the people well. He is administering justice and equity. He had a staff that helped him rule well. He had someone who ran the army, someone who recorded, some priests, a secretary, heads over different people, heads over priests. So God's blessing, God's keeping his word. And all of this reminds us of Psalm 2. Psalm 2. So turn over there with me real quick. I think we have time. Psalm 2. So Psalm 2 is all about the Lord's anointed. I don't know if you've ever read this, and obviously this is a passage that's quoted a lot in the New Testament to refer to Christ, but we can just see the extent to which this is kind of pointing to David in the short term, right? Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? This is verse 1. The kings of the earth set themselves against, and the rulers take counsel against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast their cords from us. It's exactly what's happening in chapter 8, right? All these nations are raging, and the Philistines are saying, we'll see how strong David is, and boppity bop. Philistines are taken care of. Moab, oh, we're going to flex our muscle. We'll see how great this boppity bop. Hadadezer comes down the road. Who is he? Nobody after David's done with him. You know, he's just like mopping the floor with these nations. And it's just like, why do the nations rage? Why do the peoples plot in vain? Why do they think they can raise their hand against the Lord and against his anointed one? It's not going to happen. Or down in verse 8. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. Again, this is what God's doing for David, right? Verse 10, this is kind of the summary. Now therefore, O kings, be wise and be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, kiss the Anointed One. Lest he be angry and you perish in his way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. In other words, it's better to be on the Lord's side here, right? This is what God's doing. God is keeping his word, and he's giving David the nations as a heritage. And it appears that David is wise. David's kind of heeding the warning here. He's wise. He's serving the Lord with fear. He's rejoicing with trembling. He's exercising his kingship with wisdom. He's ruling not only with military might, but by being morally upright so far. Chapter 11 is coming. And again, it's not just because David is awesome. The Lord is the one who's giving David victory and peace. So again, we don't have the same promises as David. Like, I can't wake up this tomorrow morning and think, well, God's given me the rule of this empire. You know, I don't have that promise like David did. But I can have the same kind of confidence in God that he will keep his word. Right? I can have the same kind of trust that God will do what he said. That God will make good on his word. So do you have that kind of trust in God? I mean, just think about how, as you go about life, is your life characterized by trusting, oh, this is what God said, I'm going to rest there. Or is your life characterized by like, yeah, that Bible, God doesn't know what he's talking about. That's for old days. You know, are you resting in his promises? Are you trusting that it's true? So that's really the first encouragement from chapter 8. Related to God's kingdom is that God will keep his promises. He will. It's as sure as it's going to rain again someday in Hutchinson. God will keep his promises. God will make good on this. He's going to do what he said he would do. And we need to land there. Chapter 7 was the promise. Chapter 8 is God saying, see, told you. How about them apples? He's dropping the mic, you know. So that's chapter 8. Let's turn to chapter 9. Second and finally this morning, in God's kingdom, we can be encouraged as we can keep covenant promises. I mean, I think this is the encouragement here. We can keep covenant promises. We can do that. So let's read this story. This is, again, another name that is going to trip us all up. So let's just say that before we read. Can we all say it together? We're going to say the word Mephibosheth. Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3. Mephibosheth. Okay, and you can try to, you know, have your kids like say it 5 times real fast over lunch and you know, the day will be gone, right? But this is chapter 9, David's kindness to Mephibosheth. So follow along with me as I read. David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in his feet." And the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, "Mephibosheth!" And he answered, "Behold, I'm your servant." And David said to him, "Don't fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce, that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at the king's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. So stepping into chapter 9, this is David's kindness, and it's recalling a covenant that David had made with Jonathan. So to refresh your memory, back in 1 Samuel 20, remember when Saul's trying to pin David to the wall with a spear? They come up with this plan that they're going to hatch where they'll have the archer come out and shoot the arrows, and depending on how the arrows land, David will know whether it's safe or whether he needs to be on the run. It ends up being the case that he's going to be on the run. And so they meet together and covenant together. And let me just read these verses. This is 1 Samuel 20, 12 to 17. Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you as he's been with my father. If I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever. When the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. So that was the promise that was made, right? When God takes care of all your enemies, remember your steadfast love for me. And again, God has given David safe space. God has given David rest. He has room to breathe. He is free from the trauma for a second. And so now his heart just naturally goes to love. And it goes out to act in love towards Jonathan, demonstrating that he's going to keep these covenant promises. He's going to do these things. And this shakes down beginning in verse 1. David asks, "Is there anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show kindness to for Jonathan's sake?" So kindness, when you see this, is that Old Testament word chesed, whatever. It's not a big deal. Just steadfast love, kindness, loving kindness, covenant-keeping love. David could love because he knew this covenant-keeping love, and as Psalm 136 reminds us, that the steadfast love of the Lord endures forever. If you've ever read Psalm 136, you're like, why is this in here? Like every verse, the steadfast love of the Lord endures forever. The steadfast love of the Lord endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord, our God and King. His steadfast love endures forever. It's because David knew that, right? It was instinctive. It's what he knew. So, in asking this question, David learns of a servant of Saul named Ziba, and he helps the king connect with the son of Jonathan who's crippled in his feet. And did you catch how the passage just kind of built and didn't really give us Mephibosheth's name until like right at the last moment, right? We're told that there's this son of Jonathan that's at Machir's house in Lodabar, and so the king sends for him and he comes, and we learn that his name's Mephibosheth. And you might remember in 2 Samuel 4:4, we've already met Mephibosheth, where we were told Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled, and as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Actually, I just remembered my sophomore year of high school, my biology teacher's dog was named Mephibosheth. So it's just my brain. Sorry. So Mephibosheth. What do you think Mephibosheth might have been thinking when he's summoned to the king's court? What do you think he's thinking? He's brought into the king's court in the king's fortified city, and he's asked to appear before David, and he knows that he has no relative alive. What do you think he's thinking? And this is my moment. I'm finally going to get it. And he's not thinking like he's going to get a raise or provision, right? He's thinking, this is the king. He's going to execute justice on me. I'm the last one. So, he came in and he fell on his face and paid homage, right? That was the appropriate thing to do. And the king cried out, Mephibosheth! And he answered, what? Behold, I'm your servant. I'm your servant. And look at David's kindness to Mephibosheth, right? David said, don't fear. Don't fear. That's the first word, right? He says his name and he says, chill, relax, it's okay. This is going to be a safe space for you. Don't fear. I'm going to show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. What was Saul's is yours. I'm restoring it to you. And you will always eat at my table. And Mephibosheth, ever grateful, responds and says, who am I? And what is your servant that you should show regard to a dead dog such as I? Now, Americans read dog stuff in the Bible and we're thinking, oh, that's so cute. He was like a little schnauzer to him. And that's not what Mephibosheth is saying. Dogs in that day and age kind of lived on the streets and were a little more ferocious than they are in our houses today. What Mephibosheth is saying is, I'm a nobody. You shouldn't be having regard for me. Who am I that you would have such regard for a dead dog as I? I'm a nobody. And so the passage goes on, right? The kindness is fleshed out in verses 9 and following. The king summons Ziba, commissions him to serve Mephibosheth. All that was Saul's is now Mephibosheth's. Ziba and his servants are going to serve Mephibosheth, and Mephibosheth will always eat at the king's table, at David's table. We're told of this workforce. Ziba has 15 sons, 20 servants that are going to be mobilized to do this work. And we hear the blessing that this was to Mephibosheth. Ziba rose to the task, and Mephibosheth ate at the king's table as a son, and he had children of his own. Ziba's house served him, and he lived in Jerusalem. He ate at the king's table. And then the closing word is just this vulnerability, right? That he was lame in both of his feet. He was needy, not only just for David's grace. He was needy just physically in need of David's grace. He needed this kind of kindness. So by way of application, I'm drawn to see what are ways that we can keep covenant promises? You might think, well, you know, it's kind of different. I'm not David. Yeah, of course you're not David. Neither am I. But there's covenant promises that we have, right? We have responsibilities to one another in our nuclear families. We have responsibilities to one another in the family of God. Covenant promises inform the way we act towards one another, right? Because God has said to us, right? This is the reality. This is the banner. Song of Solomon says, his banner over me is love. And the banner over our lives is covenant love. God the Father has said to us, don't be afraid. You're my child. Eat at my table. And because he said that to us, we can step out in love to others, right? We can step out in covenant faithfulness to others. We can love because he's first loved us. I think a lot of times we're paralyzed to live. We're kind of like Mephibosheth, right? We're just kind of lame in the feet. We're not doing what we need to be doing. It's like we're living. We know that we're called to love, but we're living in a far distant land away from the king's table. That's what it feels like for us. And so we have a hard time stepping out to love. But God has drawn us close through Christ. And so now, because of that, we can really live. We can live. We can keep his heart for us to show love to one another. We can live those lives of love to others. Covenant faithfulness, covenant love demands that from us. Because we have the safety of sitting at the king's table, because we have an identity that we are a king's son, we get to eat at his table forever. Now we can aggressively show love to others. And it's a beautiful and amazing thing. This section of scripture gives us an amazing incentive to really live. What would it look for you to step out and live in covenant love towards others? So, you know, I think about all those New Testament instructions we have about how families live together, right? You know, so husbands and wives and children and parents treating themselves a certain way. We have this kind of covenant language about how the church is to act together, how elders are to be treated, how elders are to function. All this covenant sticky stuff. And it's all ours because covenant love is the reality in which we live. Right? For those of us who trust Christ, it's just pronounced over our lives. Don't be afraid. You're my child. Eat at my table. And so from that, man, we have every security in the world to just aggressively go out and love. Such a great thing. We can keep covenant promises. That's an encouragement related to God's kingdom. We can keep those covenant promises. We can step out and do that. So today we've seen these two encouragements related to God's kingdom. We can be assured that God will keep his promises. So God will. He'll never renege on that. Like, he's not going to back out. He's not going to say, like, well, it's mostly finished, but there's still a lot more for you to do. No, he's going to take care of his promises. And we can keep covenant promises too. We can step out of love. We can step out of we can live out of the reality of the love that he's showered on us and relate to others with love. Turn with me to Romans 5. Romans 5. While we have Mephibosheth on the brain and all that context, Romans 5, and beginning in verse 6. Listen to how Paul puts the good news. And as you're thinking about Mephibosheth, just see if this doesn't describe us. I'm going to read down to verse 10. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we've now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. And then let's add on verse 11. More than that, we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom now we have received reconciliation. This is what God's done for us. This is the reality that God speaks over our lives. Yes, maybe society has cast you aside and said they don't have time for you and your problems. Maybe you're feeling like even this morning in this room that you just don't know my background. I don't, but God does. And God's saying here that he's come after people like you. God speaks better words than our world does. And he says that his heart of love is so big that we can be drawn near to him. That's what he's saying. Those of us who are weak, who are sinners, who are enemies of God, we've become objects of God's love. This is what God has done for us. This is the good news of the Bible, that Christ died for us, showing his love. And because of him, we can be reconciled to God. We can be saved. This is such good news. And so will you trust that? Will you trust these promises from your Father? Will you lean into that and say, yeah, man, I do feel cast aside by the world, but I will trust what you say. And if you trust him, he will in no way cast you out. He's going to keep his promise. So embrace the realities of covenant love, of God's covenant love. Don't persist as an outsider. I think there's a lot of us who we're just happy to be. We like the identity of being an outsider. We like the fact that we're lame in both feet and we can get all this sympathy from the world. And God's saying, why don't you come on in? Why don't you come on in and live under the banner of my love? Why don't you come on in and just eat at my table? Why don't you quit fearing and just trust me? And so both of those passages work together, right? Chapters 8 and 9 work together in this sense, right? God is saying, I will give you love forever. Will you trust me? And so then the implication is we can step out then in love. So don't persist as an outsider when you've been made clean and you've been invited to the king's table to eat. I mean, this is such good news. Oh, just trust that this is what David is doing in the passage with Mephibosheth, is what God has done for us sinners. So let's trust him. Let's lean into that. Let's bask in the reality of covenant love. Don't fear. Don't fear. come to him. So it's such good news. And if you're a believer, the simple truths for us today are to trust God's promises and to live out love. We have amazing confidence for these tasks because God's with us. We're not alone. So when you think, well, I don't know what covenant love looks like here. Yeah, you do. Just look to your Father. He knows how to love. He knows how to love perfectly. Right? He gets it right. You might say, well, I don't know what it looks like to love people in this world. Yeah, you do. Just look to the Father, right? And relate out of that. God's not going to change his mind and give us a raw deal. He's loving us. He's drawing us out. And he's drawing us out to deeper expressions of love for his glory and for our good. So today then, I want you to be encouraged to trust him deeply. And I want you to have every confidence in the world that his word is true and it's good. So that's one implication. I think chapter 8 is just dropping the hammer on that, that God will make good on his promises. You can trust that it's all good. He's going to take care of it. It's good and it's true. And step out in love. We can live this out because God has said to us that you're my son, you're my daughter, don't fear, eat at my table. Because God said that to us, we can step out and exercise that kind of covenant love to others in the body, in our families. You are God's child. You are eating at his table. He has set you free from fear and shame. So let's live. And let's live in a way that would glorify and enjoy him forever. So Father, thank you for these words, these chapters. They just seem like mundane things tucked away under big chapters in the Old Testament, but they're really communicating to us a lot about who you are. They're communicating to us that we can trust your word and that you'll never give up on a promise that you've made to your people. You will make good on that. And also, it's just showing us the love that you've showered on your people. David got this right. He lived out of that covenant love. And help us as a body to live out of the covenant love that you've extended to us. This is how we live in your kingdom. And so much of our Christian living is like looking at a magic eye puzzle. And we're just wondering, what is this? And you're calling us to love. You're calling us to these basic things, to trust and to love and to walk in these ways. So give us help to do this. And we're so thankful that you've given us your spirit. We're not left to ourselves. You've given us your spirit. You've placed us in a body. And so let us find encouragement to really live in a way that would honor you. And so we ask for help with all this in Jesus' name. Amen.